Three Peeps in a Podcast. Okay, so welcome to Three Peeps in a Podcast. Nick Elston, how the devil are you?
Hey, Patch, I'm very good, thank you. How are you, mate?
Yeah, not bad at all, not bad at all. So Nick and I first met probably 3 or 4 years ago when you came to my workplace and you delivered one of your talks. And I just took it upon myself to send you a message, I think, on LinkedIn and say how great I thought it was. And everyone got a lot from it. Talking anxiety was, I think, the subject that obviously now you're going all over the country and in some cases the world delivering. So
yeah,
just tell us a little bit about your background. You're a Bristol boy, born and bred. Whereabouts in Bristol are you from?
Yeah, so I was born, I was born in Yates, but then when I was about two, we moved to Kingswood, and most of my kind of childhood was spent in Kingswood, and then ended up coming full circle back in Yates. But so in terms of kind of my stuff and kind of why I do what I do now as a speaker, so the flag that I fly under is lived experience of mental health, and basically that acts as a disclaimer that I'm not a medical professional. So what I share is insight, not advice, and increase engagement on things like mental health and well-being and that kind of thing. The reason I got to that point was a lot to do with kind of my childhood. I had obsessive compulsive disorder as a kid, and OCD. I mean, I'm 42 now, so the treatment, in inverted commas, back in the day was purely just a kind of a talking therapy-based thing. Awareness not as high as it is now, so it dealt with some of the obsession, some of the compulsion, but actually what it left me with, which has been my biggest challenge in kind of adult life, was later diagnosed as generalized anxiety disorder, GAD, and that's less commonly known but statistically more common. So some of the things that you may find with GAD is that you find yourself constantly catastrophizing. It could be that you're always assuming a negative outcome to everyday stuff, to every conversation you have. Maybe that you replay kind of your past mistakes continuously in a loop in your head. Lots of different things kind of in terms of physically, it's like you're on a hamster wheel, so you kind of you're very anxious and uptight about something, and as soon as that one thing ends, you replace that with something else. And a lot of people kind of really resonate with that, and statistically 28% of the country has that to some degree. So but it's less commonly known, which is really fascinating. But I guess what they don't tell you, and I've kind of built a reputation as a speaker saying things that they don't tend to say about mental health, and it does drive you. I think that energy does drive you, especially energy.
Yeah, just going back to explore a little bit about your growing up with OCD.
Yeah,
sure.
Just tell them whenever you want, mate.
Well, just tell us some examples of the things that, you know, I see OCD as having your shoes straight and all in a line and cans in the fridge all facing the right way. Tell us a little bit about the things you experienced, and, you know, people listening may experience similar things.
Yeah, sure. So again, mine started at a very early age. And so what happened with that, how it manifested itself, was I would, it's an overview. OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, is it's a safety mechanism, but it's a safety mechanism gone wrong. And you find that a lot with anxiety as well, that we create anxiety in the trying to control the uncontrollable. And OCD is one of those mechanisms. So for me, there was always a perceived outcome and there was always a trigger. So if I didn't do these series of events, this routine, this comfort zone a bit in my own head, then something really bad would happen if I didn't do those things. And what you find is that rationality goes out the window when you look at mental illness, especially because the compulsion remains just as high. So how it would manifest would be, I would check locks in sets of three, gas switches in sets of three, light switches in sets of three. And for those kind of tuned in who know about OCD, they've got experience of this with maybe their loved ones, is if you can't get the loop just right, you go and you go and you go until you get it right. But interestingly, a lot of the time, even at a young age, I was kind of keeping that in, really.
What sort of young age are we talking here, Nick? When did it sort of manifest?
So it's really difficult to kind of put an exact age. Now, I think it's around seven. I think I was around seven.
Okay.
kind of after speaking to kind of family about this kind of like in adult life. And the other thing to say is that we have this assumption that broken people come from broken environments, but it's not always the case. It can be the case, but it's not always the case that you can have a loving upbringing, and I had, and have a loving family, and they did everything right, but stuff still happens along the way, and then sometimes these things just kind of trigger and happen. And that's why they kind of took me to a GP. The GP kind of put me into this kind of counselling kind of thing. But it didn't address a lot of it. And actually what I find is that if I'm really stressed or tired now, I have to be very careful about kind of, in my case, checking things. So if I check something more than once, it could be the door's locked or the dog's in the kitchen, or I got to stop if I keep kind of having that urge to check and check again.
And how? What technique do you use to do that? Is it sort of saying, thank you, brain, move on?
It is an inner dialogue thing. It is really interesting. There's little kind of tricks, depending on where I am at the time in terms of how I'm feeling. I have used little things like, so for example, I live on quite a busy road here. So if I want to make sure the dog's in the kitchen, even though there's a door in the way and like logically there's no way the dog can get out, that I would leave like a Satsuma or a kind of a memory hook on the side by the basket on the floor. So actually when I close the door and think, right, where's the dog in the basket? I would automatically think of the Satsuma, which right. is great, but I'll have Satsumas all over the house. I kind of jest, but it's kind of what we're trying to do, and it's something that I kind of use now in what I do as a speaker and as a coach as well, is that I use things called brain hacks, and actually kind of what we're trying to do is disrupt our thinking and disrupt our conditioning. But so when my mind went straight to, in this instance, is the dog in the kitchen, straight away I would automatically remember, yes, because the orange or Satsuma was next to the thing. So it's right. trying to find something else which was unique to that situation that you would automatically distract yourself to. So another one would be, I've not used this myself, but people that I've spoken to have. So if your thing is about kind of, did you leave the gas on or did you lock the door? Maybe for a while, they'll just take a picture of it off and take it with them until they convince themselves enough that their thinking is irrational. And it's not always as easy as that. And like everything in life, there's so many kind of different degrees of that. And
I was going to say, I often leave the house, get halfway into work and think, I didn't actually shut the front door, because you're in completely an autopilot state that you just think, I haven't done it. I can't remember actually doing it this morning, but you often have, and you might always have. But I guess you've got different degrees of this. If it's happening every day versus if it's happening once a month.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's why in terms of the work I do now in kind of adult life, that's why I focus on more mental health element as opposed to the mental illness, because actually OCD is kind of a really crippling, frustrating, painful kind of illness that does need medical attention, does need help, and because it manifests itself in different ways, it's really important that happens. So I never profess to go against any form of medical advice, for example, but what I do is actively signpost to it. So I actually increase the engagement in the stuff that's out there already, because, and it has to be said in blokes as well, blokes are terrible at reaching out for help and even just stepping up to share stuff. So kind of my kind of niche is lived experience of mental health and the mental illness that I kind of tell my experiences so that people can understand and relate if they've been in that situation. But in no way is it treated as advice, should we say.
Yeah. So growing up with this OCD, as it was known back then, and you said that back then it was all about just going to the doctors, but obviously it's a much bigger thing, much more talked about thing these days. But going through sort of senior school and things like that, were your friends aware of it, and how did you sort of cope with school life and exams and things?
This is really interesting, because as I said, that GAD, and which is generalized anxiety disorder, and any heightened anxiety actually kind of harnesses the same energy as things like excitement and things like adrenaline and that kind of thing. So you it does kind of push you to succeed, but it can also push you down kind of corridors like people pleasing is a great one, in terms of especially a school environment, can be quite brutal. So all intents and purposes, that I was head boy or head prefect in schools, in the schools I was at, and very good in terms of grades, in terms of knuckling down, I was popular with everybody. So to the outer kind of experience, like, all was well. But as I talk about, as you know, Patch, that that were conditioned through our youth. So it's interesting that at the same time, I was also labelled as sensitive or a worrier, that and not as a harmful thing, but actually sometimes it's kind of like a compliment thing, and you kind of see that in people, and also the challenges that I had in life. You kind of, like, anxiety, like in my adult life, we can usually trace back to kind of our conditioning through our youth, where those kind of stem from. So anxiety is a big problem for me and has been for members of my family. You've got things like weight and weight loss. When I think about kind of, and again, through nothing but love, I was told by my grandparents, like, he's a big lad, he loves his food. Go figure, I'm a big lad, I love my food. I was told that for a long time. So it's been a hard thing to kind of break down. There's lots of different things that I've kind of conditioned along the way. We've all got that stuff. We've all, if we look back, we can kind of understand that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So going through school didn't affect your exams and things like that, or does it sort of help in a way?
It does. I think that's the thing. And so going through exams were really good. I found it quite not easy. That's not the right word. But it wasn't a kind of a big challenge for me. Because
revising for exams and things like that. If you've got some sort of OCD, that can probably help bring some structure to, you know, actually doing it.
Yeah, like I said, it's there's that element for sure. And for some reason, it just wasn't ever a problem. I mean, my memory is not the best of times, but when I look back now and I look at certain elements of school, then there's never a case where I felt under pressure. But so, and I kind of relate this to my corporate kind of professional life. It's that if you take that into, like, our adult kind of life, and you must see this a lot kind of in your world as well, that you have, when you take those elements of kind of like the anxiety and high performance and not letting the ball drop into a corporate life, that's why things like burnout and stress and everything that comes with that is rife. And now more than ever. And that's kind of what I did. I took that kind of thing into my corporate life, and top account manager, top sales manager for a company, and you just don't let the ball drop. And I see it so clearly now in kind of in other people that I work with. And it's no coincidence that most of the industries that I work with the most, things like law and financial services and contact centers, are huge for me as well. So they're environments that actually are quite intense, or very intense, but also a lot of environments that he who leaves first loses kind of environment. So
yeah,
we basically stay on that kind of hamster wheel still. And then that's kind of how it was. And I didn't really, I think my old kind of challenges were kind of masked to a certain extent. And then kind of fast forward to about 7 years ago now, that I went to a business networking meeting. Now, for those who are not familiar with business networking meetings, it's kind of where you go and you pretend to be happy and try and sell your stuff to the other people in the room.
Yeah.
And I did this a lot, and I left this one meeting, and it's so vivid in my head that kind of it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened. But I left this one meeting and I just felt massively overwhelmed, very frustrated, and I'd lost a lot of hope that things were going to kind of change. I was constantly anxious about lots of different things, both personally and professionally. And again, it's interesting that my personal kind of circumstances, my environment hasn't changed. The one thing that changed was me. So sometimes we're completely the right place, we just don't see it for what it is. So I'd have a lot of anxieties about family, I'd have a lot of anxieties about social stuff, and but I wasn't really speaking about that, and I was wearing a mask, so I was trying to be what people wanted to see in me, and I was trying to be what situations demanded of me, but I damn sure wasn't going to show myself, because when we share ourselves, especially when it comes to mental health, that our narrative tells us that we're going to be shot at. That's exactly what we would tell ourselves, or words to that effect, that when we show our true selves. And it was at that point I had kind of like a real meltdown moment. It was outside of a Premier Inn in Somerset. Classy guy. Choose your breakdowns well. And Lemmy Henry was nowhere to be seen, which is quite annoying. He's all over the place in Premier Inn usually. Funny, I was talking about this stuff for a living now, that I would have gone with Hilton or someone more exclusive and got a deal out of it or something, but it is what it is. And what kind of works out is that the one thing that we all have in common is that we all need hope of something better. Not just hope, but hope of something better, no matter where we are. And it's when people lose that, that's the real kind of, I guess, danger point with things like kind of burnout and breakdown and that kind of stuff. And it was then I took a really weird decision to, the other thing was, again, wearing that mask, as we do, we give ourselves away to appease other people and situations. But interestingly, that I would wear a different mask for different situations. I would be someone completely different in work than I was at home, and then different with my family, my friends, and lots of different things. And people seem to really kind of relate to that. So 2 weeks later, I spoke after the same meeting, and I shared about that happening. I shared about OCD and kids and lots of different things. And it was a terrible talk. I was shaking and crying. And my narrative 100% told me it was going to go one way, which was kind of like death by police, blaze of glory kind of thing. But 100% it went the other way, that everybody in the room offered their support. Everybody in the room queued up to give me a hug. I love hugs, as you know. So come on, baby. But the third thing really changed my perspective. And this is why I do what I do now, is because what I found was the dynamic changed instantly, because people that I've known for years started immediately telling me about all of their stuff. That actually, when we are completely truthful, genuinely truthful with people, they automatically build a bridge of trust, and they shared straight back with me. So that meant very quickly I got good at actively signposting, and I spoke more and more and more. And in 2017, it became my job. I went full-time professional as a speaker. And then from that point, I've now gone on to build a business from that as well, helping other people to speak as well.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about that leap of faith into becoming a guest speaker. To doing what you do now. Did you have any, obviously, being someone who's dealt with anxiety in the past, when you did your first sort of speaking session to a large group, how did that go? Did you have any moments where you thought, I can't do this? Or, because I know you still experience some of that now for a man who actually delivers it as a job.
Yeah, massively. So, I mean, I will go on to, as you know, because I've done this with you there twice, I will go on to a stage and say, no matter how many people in the room, whether it's 10 or 10,000, that I use it called a disarming truth, that actually when we tell people how we're feeling, that straight away we see our problems in the third-party perspectives. We see things differently and it looks more manageable. So I always tell my audiences, I'm anxious right now. Who wouldn't be? I'm just about to bear my soul to a ring full of people I don't know. But actually, the process of me saying that actually means that within a few minutes, I find my flow and I'm okay. So I think to start with, it was more so, it wasn't the case of speaking, because actually when it comes to speaking, especially, is a great example that we create anxiety in a thought of doing something, but not weirdly the doing it. When we're actually doing it, we manage it. But it's the thought of something, it's the assumption of you're going to bomb, they're not going to get this kind of stuff. And there's techniques that you can use, like breathing and using your pace and tone and volume to structurally, as long as you've got that right, you can do that. The most interesting thing from that was that I learned that I was a natural introvert, that I recharge in my own company, but I was living the life of an extrovert, and I had been for a long time, even in sales. So by giving myself that kind of time to recharge after every event meant I can go again stronger. But I learned the hard way, because within a few months of going self-employed doing this full-time, it really started to impact me negatively. So again, it's always been an evolution. It's always a kind of a work in progress. And it's a fascinating thing. But actually, it's interesting that I don't feel the nerves about getting up to, or the anxiety about getting up to speak per se, is actually hacking my brain before I get up to speak.
Yeah. So 2017, when you started, that I'm sure that was the year that you came into my workplace, and
I think it was actually, yeah.
might have been one of the first ones that you did. And And, you know, I reached out to you straight away and thought it was well delivered. So you obviously hit the ground running. But yeah. Over the last sort of 3 years that you've been doing this then, tell us a little bit about the places you've been, the types of organisations. Is it one specific type? And
so no, I would say 90% of my work is done with HR leaders in a corporate environment, people that have wellbeing initiatives, but you want to boost engagement. What you get from me, I've been described as brutally honest. So
yeah, not rude. Sort of,
yeah, not rude. Just brutally. I mean, brutally honest about myself. But what that means is that you get the buy-in from people that wouldn't engage in a classroom environment. So that's kind of what I do 90% of the time initially with my speaking stuff. I also start to speak at big kind of conferences and shows, kind of like London XL and Liberty Stadium and Cardiff City Stadium, that kind of thing, and conferences around those kind of things. So schools, universities, lots of organisations. I'm due to speak in a prison later in the year as well, which will be, it's going to be a really different experience. But I think what I love about what I do is the fact that I get to meet so many people. I get to see so many different kind of walks of life and different environments and stuff that actually gives me a really good rounded knowledge of what it takes to kind of really kind of develop people as well. So the business I launched on the back of that is called Forging People. Now, Forging People came from a line of my talk, is that in life, these adversities that not just me, but all of you guys and you, yeah. These adversities that we kind of suffer sometimes, they can either define us negatively for the rest of our days, or we can choose to allow it to forge something beautiful. We can allow it to forge something powerful that never existed without you going through your stuff in the first place. And for me, that kind of gives the world a great synchronicity. It gives the fact that you can use your the energy and your struggle as a catalyst for positive change. So actually know that you can give birth to an idea which has come from adversity but turned out to provide the most exciting thing, most exciting future that you could never have imagined. And for me, that's what I love. So in terms of the kind of my kind of business part of that is I help people to speak. So this isn't presentation skills per se. It's about emotional storytelling. So what you find is I run monthly academies in Bristol, do one-to-one stuff. What you find is that when people have a space where they feel safe, and I always give people the out of, look, you can make stuff up, but actually people decide to share everything. It turns very much into a not just public speaking, it's about personal development.
So you go past the usual advice of just imagine everyone naked, yeah?
No, no, trust me. You all want to see this naked, so I wouldn't wish on anybody else either. So this is the clear difference. I think you've got lots of different organizations that help you kind of Toastmasters and lots of different kind of speaking organizations. Yeah. But my focus is on emotional storytelling. I actually bring in a well-being professional every single event because actually can get really kind of, it can get quite emotional sometimes. So people are deciding to share things. I mean, I've got people that have been, I'm working with a guy through the academy, he's been through the London bombings, the guy who's been through different mental health conditions, that the power that they've actually created, they still had the same experience and they've had the same story, the same adversity, but what they've done now is to reframe it into something that they can bring a value to an audience. They can use their story as a kind of a real catalyst to come away from that and actually give people real insight into what it is to be going through that experience. Because touch wood, hopefully none of us will ever go through those things. So people can learn from the stories that people have. And I think storytelling is so ingrained in us as humans, and it's the most powerful way of learning. And it never dies. Storytelling never dies. And I think that's kind of a lot of what I'm trying to do is to help people use these adversities to turn it into a legacy for them.
And it's become, storytelling has become such a big part of the corporate world in recent years. There was always that old adage of the jobs of the future don't exist yet. And because people have stopped being, you know, project managers and gone off and become storytellers, which is all massively important things. It's all new cultures, but people, you know, if someone's telling a story really well, it's going to help people develop, learn new things, and it's become a massive part of the organization.
It has, and I think even from a business point of view, I get people come along who want to sell their business better or network better, because actually what you do when you wrap your personal story around your offering or your product, you make yourself bulletproof, because you literally, there'll be nobody else doing what you do with your experience, that combination of those things. So it works on every level. And again, it's just great to see the transformation in people when they start to firstly kind of, I firmly believe, we're getting quite deep now. I firmly believe we have all the answers we'll ever need. We just don't ask ourselves the right questions. Or if we do ask ourselves the right questions, we're scared of the truth. And what I mean by that is that sometimes that could be our conditioning. Sometimes it could be, you see this in people, they could be stuck in a toxic relationship or a toxic work environment or a job that they don't want to be in. But actually, it's harder to do something about it than it is to stay in a position of pain and frustration.
From the talk that you delivered at my organization a few months back, the thing that people obviously remember lots of it, but the one thing that people remember is that when you said question everything, that was the sort of the strap line that you sort of left us with. And people started doing that. It really is a powerful thing to say to yourself.
It is. I mean, so, as I said, the exercise that you allude to, that is, if you wake up tomorrow, why do you wake up at this time? Could you do it more sleep or less sleep? Why do you wake up next to them is a question maybe you haven't asked in a while. It's true. We don't ask ourselves a big question sometimes because we don't really want to know the answers at times. And it's why do you have that for breakfast? Does it nourish you? Does it deplete you? And the other thing is not just asking kind of or not questioning why you're doing what you're doing, but how we actually speak to ourselves. And that's interesting too, because if you're not feeling life right now and you say to yourself, I am rubbish. Yeah, that's definitely you. That's your self-confidence because you're speaking in the first person to yourself. But the scary thing is, and it's truly scary, is that most of the time we will say to ourselves, you are rubbish, to ourselves, which psychologically is what somebody else has told you enough for it to become your conditioning. And it's so easy to be shaped by other people and your surroundings. And there's an American author called Jim Rohn who says you're the average of the people you surround yourself with. And I love that. And I can really see that in, I mean, the people that are kind of the closest people, not just your Facebook friends and things.
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of another speaker called Sean Acre in the States.
No.
And he wrote a short story about, it's called The Orange Frog, and that's something that we've been looking at in our organization lately. And the orange frog, basically, there was four green frogs. One frog started doing things that made him happy, and he realized he was turning orange. And he kept doing these things, and everyone was going to him, you know, you're weird, you're turning orange, cover it up with moss, what are you doing? And he said, oh, okay. And then he thought, no, I'm doing things that are making me happy here, I'm turning orange. And he went completely orange, and, you know, he became a positive outlier that people wanted, you know, that they all wanted to eventually go orange because they could see how happy he was. And the underlying sort of message is, you could look at a graph and you could see a lovely line that goes up steadily and everyone's like the average. And then you get this one little dot that's completely out of place. And instead of studying the average, study the person that's making a difference and being slightly different. Because if you study average, you're gonna get average. So many facts you hear are the average number of people that do this or the average IQ is X. That's what you're not aspiring to. That you're aspiring to be, you know, above the average or a positive outlier. That's the sort of message it's bringing across.
I love that. I heard you mention that at your conference, and I've actually bookmarked to read that now you come to mention it. It's really, really fascinating. And a lot of the time is this stuff, it's not people intentionally kind of like trying to push you one way or another. It's just stuff that we kind of pick up. And again, that's why the importance of having a really healthy work culture, because actually most of the time we spend our time in a work environment that, making sure that's a healthy place to be is really important.
Healthy and happy place to be as well. Yeah, it's there's a lot of people who say, you get happiness from success, but you get more success from being happy. Is another sort of mantra, but it's a lot of theory that we probably didn't look at and think about 5-10 years ago, but in a new world of mental health being at the forefront of people's minds, and now men getting more, it's more acceptable to talk about it with other men. It's a real powerful thing that you're doing and that you're delivering at, in your talks, and obviously helping people with the way that they speak and the Forging People stuff you're working on. But just a question on the Forging People. Is it people of all sort of skill levels? So people that are just starting out and have never spoken before, or people that are comfortable doing it and they want to get better?
So there's a real mixture. So there are people that are – I mean, I have speaking coaches that come to my speaking days because my focus is on emotional storytelling, and that's not a big focus for real anybody doing – that kind of element in itself. But I've got a professional sports person who's come along, and I've worked one-on-one with, who's now going out and doing kind of motivational talks and things. But I've also got people that have come along just for having that space to be able to talk, just to be able to open up to a room full of supportive people in a non-judgmental environment. And then I've got people that go to like business networking events, or maybe like yourself, you need a team of people and they just want to become a little bit more effective in terms of tuning in emotionally to people. But yes, I mean, that's kind of like one of the main drivers. I also do things like kind of coaching and mentoring anyway. So especially in the construction industry, again, interestingly male dominated, but with its own really kind of strict set of challenges. So I work one-to-one with kind of senior leaders in construction too. It's just, again, it's a niche I've fallen into. And this year, the next step is this month, actually, I've got mental health first aid training for 2 days, which will allow me to be able to kind of really dig down into the lived experience stuff I'm doing, but also then have a deeper understanding of the illness side of things. And then the next step is to be a mental health first aid instructor trainer. So that's later in the year, where I then will be qualified to go and help other people to help other people. And I think that's really my kind of my raison d'etre. It's kind of at the heart of everything I do. It's all about, I mean, even the company handles a new breed of people development. I try and help people. I try and develop people by doing it a different way. It's very much kind of, you've seen me, mate, I've got jeans, cap and a shirt on, and it's very informal, it's very inclusive, and it's not for everybody, but actually what I find is that the kind of old things we have of, to be taken seriously, you need to be suited and booted, just doesn't happen. But my conditioning told me it did, but I've never lost a gig on wearing caps and jeans to even big, like the world's leading law firms, and they beam me out across. I do some things called beanbacks in law, where I'll go, they have amazing kind of auditoriums in the London law firms, and they'll show it all over the world. So there are other kind of offices around the world, and it's an amazing experience, because then they can interact, it's amazing questions and things. So it's a great experience. But what you find is, I'm not sure if it's reassuring or unsettling, that everybody has the same challenges, and there are some cultural differences, but actually, essentially, everybody has the same challenges. In fact, today I was at an event where somebody said that they'll look at somebody who's famous and think, well, they've got all the trappings of success and the material stuff. And actually, the people still struggle the same. And we've seen that. I mean, you've got the people, sadly, like Robin Williams is a great example of, to the outside world, is kind of happy. He's got everything in terms of the definition of success. And it doesn't matter. It genuinely doesn't matter unless we're actually walking in somebody's shoes. And I think that the one thing I do kind of try and leave an audience with is that as humans, we kind of have this kind of desire to fix people, which is done with the very, very best of intentions. But if somebody comes to us to open up, potentially for the first time ever, then our responsibility isn't to fix them, it's to listen to them. As in properly listen to them. Because essentially in life, people just want to be heard and they want to be understood. And if you can fulfill those two things, like 90% of the time, they'll find their own way forward. The one responsibility that I think we can all take on is how to actively signpost. how to get access to people like, so I'm a Time to Change mental health champion. I also refer to people like the Money Charity for financial wellbeing. I refer to kind of Mind and Mental Health UK, which I know is a charity that's close to you as well. And all those kind of organizations. So our responsibility is really just to actively signpost and not take on the need to fix people. Because there's a real growing epidemic of the people that step up to be mental health first aiders, for example, do so because they've got a real strong desire or previous experience of mental health. But actually, then they start to take on the challenges of everybody else that's opening up to them. And actually, who looks after the people that looks after people?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's strange. It's often the people that put their hand up for mental health first aider, mental health advocate, whatever you want to call it, are the people that have had a run-in with it in the past. So yes. The question is, if someone comes to you and it gets quite heavy and you take on that burden, what's that going to do to you as a person?
Exactly. And actually, that I mean, we've had this conversation at the event because I think it's an important point. But most times, kind of people will come to me afterwards and say, right, how can I help my husband? How can I help my wife, my brother, my sister, the closest people to us? And trust me, like, very relevant to me, that the closer you are to somebody, the harder it is to help them, because they see you as a different role in life. They see you as they don't see you as a solution. They see you as just somebody who's just the brother, just the sister, just the husband, just the kind of the wife. So the only way that we can genuinely help people is just by knowing how to signpost, actively signpost and actively listen.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're almost at the end of our allotted slot because I am in my kitchen and my wife does want her tea.
I'm not going to stand in the way of that, mate. That's fine.
Me and my food. But I just wanted to very quickly explore, you said about emotional storytelling earlier on, yeah. And you must have done some emotional storytelling whilst you were doing your hospitality job at Bristol Rovers after a game. Off the back of defeats when you're trying to interview the man of the match. For example, the Bolton home game, which I was at, and we still had to identify who was man of the match. How did you get that gig and how did you find it?
Maybe that's why I find speaking so easy, is because when you've tried to do some hospitality work at Bristol Rovers, that's the real challenge in life. Trying to put a spin on a ridiculous defeat. So how I got, see, this is really simple. How I got that gig, I asked for it, and I think I see that a lot. I see that a lot in life generally. Is that people say, "Oh, I'd love to do that one day," and I was doing that. I thought, well, it's my club. It's kind of what I've been growing up for. My dad, my granddad, and my season ticket holder for years. And I thought, okay, well, I had the email address of the director for charity stuff I was doing. I just asked. I said, "Look, is there any opportunity to come and just help you on a match day and just be involved in stuff?" And so I did. He just said, "Yeah." And I think it's as simple as that. Sometimes if there's something you really want, just first off, ask. You just never know.
Well, I'll try that then. I would love to do that sort of thing down Ashton Gate with the facilities that they've got now, and they've got a couple of lounges going on. So it's something that I've got earmarked as on my list that I want to do in the future. Obviously, as you said, I remember you saying, you know, you were missing sort of still on the terraces with your mate, which I think I was probably missing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bottom. It sounds great, and it was great to see behind the scenes and to meet the players and that kind of stuff, and really enjoyed doing that. But what I found was that my headspace was on the terraces. My headspace was at 3 o'clock. I was watching the game with my mates, and because I wasn't doing that, I didn't have the headspace anymore. So actually, it felt like another day of work, even though work is a strong word. I still felt like I was missing out on just having that kind of time, which we all need, that kind of our own things to enjoy and immerse ourselves in. So I did it I did it a few times last season. I did it for the first half of this season. It's knocked on the head. But like I said, mate, I think it's just a case of just asking for it. I know when we did a charity walk for Headway.
You still got some involvement with the club. I saw you were doing something with the club that you're probably going to want to say.
And we also took in Ashton Gate as well, and John Lansdowne drove down to meet us and took us on the pitch, much to the groundskeeper's disgust, because we had a game that night. but they were very, very welcoming. And I think it's just a case sometimes of if there's something you really want, just ask. Yeah. And then take it from there.
Cool. Okay, Nick. Well,
I think you'd be really good at it, mate. I'm not saying this because I'm speaking to you. I genuinely think you would be good at it.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Yeah, I'll hopefully get the opportunity one day. But Nick, just let people know how they can get in touch with you. What, Facebook, Instagram? Yep. What's your channels?
So I'm on all of the channels. It depends where I'm talking, as opposed to where people follow up. If I go to universities, it tends to be Instagram, like, you know, I mean, kind of age relevant kind of thing. But you can find it all through nickelston.com. So it's nickelston.com. So on there, you can find all of my contacts, all of my socials, and also all the events that I've got coming up over the next, up to August.
Great. And then obviously, if you are listening and are looking for a guest speaker, look no further than the man himself, Nick Elston. Thanks for joining us, Nick.
Awesome. No worries, mate. Thank you very much.
We will speak again soon. Can you take care?
Yeah, you too. Cheers, Pat. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Last year, we did a series of podcast interviews with Jack Phillips, the manager here at David Lloyd and Emerson's Green. And I'm just catching up with Jack almost 3 months on now, not quite, but not far off. And just seeing, you know, how things are going with you, a few more grey hairs creeping in. I've been up a bit in the last 3 months, and I just wonder what a day is for you. What is day like for you? Because sometimes you're fixing a coffee machine, and other times you're having meetings. Yeah. How's it going? What is a general day for you?
Okay, so the club has been born, which is fantastic. We've now got 3,500 members, and the usage is really, really high. So what's really good is that the members that have joined are using us both early in the morning, late at night, throughout the day. The people of Lloyd Green and Emerson's Green certainly like to drink, because our bar revenue is pretty high. But a typical day is just meeting and greeting clients and members, making sure that the facility is kept up together, kept running. Obviously, with any new build, it's like if you bought a new car, a new house, you might get some teething problems. And so far, so good. We haven't had many, but any that we have had, we've been working very quickly with the contractors to get that rectified. And the usage is now petering off into people are finding sort of what level of usage they want from it. We kind of know our peak times. We do get some surprises, which is always nice. Friday evening seems to be the hit where everybody wants to come in and just drink, to be honest.
Okay. I was going to say, I can't think of working out on a Friday night.
No. I think it's that pre-drinks workout. They come in, they have a good time in the gym, and then they sit down and socialise downstairs, which is great. And we've started putting on like live singers and things like that once a month. We've got a Valentine's sort of evening that we're planning just to make it a bit more social. And it's really good. There's a few offers that are coming through, say sort of buy one, get one free on meals, and kids eat free
this week. I saw that.
Which is really great. We've got a new menu launch coming up in the next 6 weeks. And slowly we're evolving into quite an established David Lloyd. And what's really nice is, you know, you never really know how it's going to work out until you open the doors. And the first 2 weeks was crazy. I mean, everybody wanted to see it. The feedback was amazing, naturally.
Yeah.
And actually, it's still a really, really great place to work. I love coming here every day. I've started training with the members as well, and you see lots of friendly faces. And people just like a little bit of just genuine conversation. It's that, you know, they're not sort of targeting me for anything negative. It's just they want to get to know us and the team and sort of David Lloyd ethos and message that we're trying to put back.
Do you ever go undercover as like a secret shopper?
Yeah.
Not everyone will know who you are.
Not really. I sometimes try and wear a baseball cap and hide in the gym, but unfortunately a lot of members find me, and they, you know, we train together, which is great. But it was really starting to look at opportunities in the community over the next sort of, I guess the next 3-4 months, as the weather starts getting better, we'll go to local schools and we'll work with sort of local villages, village halls, and do some fetes and things like that to try and get out in the marketplace and actually give something back, because the residents of Emerson's Green and Lloyd Green have just been superb. The support's been amazing. And I know, look, you know, whilst we've been building, it was a bit tricky with the roundabout just outside the club and the highways that we had to close and try and help keep Sainsbury's afloat, because I bought so much water from them to keep the marketing suite open. I think I could have taken shares out in the company. But the membership has been great. We're playing about with some classes, so we're trying to find sort of most popular classes. Blaze has gone down amazingly well. We've got sort of Cyclone and Rhythm, which are our spinning and cycling classes that are coming through. And then as we sort of see the fairer weather coming in, the outdoor areas will really, really come into play. And I think that's going to be something really exciting for this club. Not many clubs in David Lloyd have got space like that, and that's going to be really important.
Yeah, and it's an ideal time to launch, really, in November, because you had the buzz of it being open, and then you had January, which is everyone wants to go to the gym and detox and things like that. So your first 3 months have just been absolutely crazy.
I'm glad you said that, because I thought it was a really bad time to open. been crazy busy. But yeah, look, I mean, Christmas was just a bit of an inconvenience for everyone who works at the club, because we were sort of fully rolling out the club and open. And as I said, everybody came in and it was really lighthearted. It's great fun to work over the holiday period. But yeah, it's back to work. January is, as we've hit it hard. Lots and lots of members are sort of achieving their New Year's goals, and what we're trying to do is just make sure that comes into their lifestyle and they form a habit. The great news is that 3 months in, we're way ahead of where we thought we'd be, and we'll keep going. And it's about managing the business expectation, but also the members' expectation. And we've got to make sure that the service and standards are maintained whilst we build this business. You know, and it is a business to make money, but we can't make money unless our members are happy. And that is my sort of aim in how I run a club. So, you know, we are dealing with people that are parking in disabled bays when they shouldn't be. You know, we are trying to manage the footfall of people coming in cars at peak times to try and make sure that we can get the car parking availability. And our class usage is really high. So book in advance and use the app is what I'd say. I'd encourage everybody to get on the app to try and, you know, feed their fitness habits through the app. Because otherwise you might not get into classes anymore.
Yeah, I mean, the app is really easy to use. I think, you know, I would be interested to know what the sort of uptake in number of members versus number of downloads of the apps like and things like that, and people are actually using it, because, you know, it's not for everyone. But yeah, very simple to use, and I'd recommend that one. You said about you've got some events coming up, like Valentine's and things like that. That's great that it's, you know, you've got the well-being, you've got the gym, but you're also starting to do events as well.
Yeah, we're trying to build a club within a club. So clubbiness is something that we really sort of find works in David Lloyd. You know, we've got 3,500 members that are from our local demographic. And actually, you know, when you look at sort of Lloyd Green, Emerson's Green, and where is it people can go to socialise and do sport at the same time, there isn't anywhere. And that's quite unique for us. So we want to make sure that there is that place to stop and have a drink. We've obviously got non-alcoholic drinks as well as alcohol. So,
which are actually quite nice.
Just come and enjoy an event. And, you know, we put that on. It's free of charge. It's part of the membership. And yeah, just come and enjoy it with us. And you'll get to know other people because everybody's in the same boat. Your statistic on the app, 87% of our members are using the app, so there you go.
Blimey, that's really impressive. That is great. So there's this big thing in sort of the financial sector at the moment around transforming the business, failing fast to then learn from your mistakes. So you're 3 months in. What would you say was the biggest learning for you in this three-month period?
Take a four-month build program and open it in three. That's probably the toughest learning I'll take. No, look, I just think you never know how ready you're going to be until the day you open. We put all the plans in place. We recruited really well, and I'm really pleased that the team that we recruited before we opened, a lot of them were external. They were locally to the marketplace, and they've been tremendous. And I think it's about making sure you give people the time, the training up front, and as long as you're smiling, you can get away with murder, I think. And you know, everybody is still smiling. And look, it's early days. The club has launched. It's been fantastic. The figures are unprecedented. It's been the fastest growing David Lloyd club in the country with the most members, which is great. But for me, it's about making sure people get the best service and they get fit and they enjoy us as a lifestyle. And I know that you're saying about the well-being piece for us. It's really important that we talk about mindfulness and well-being. This is a real wellness club. We've got a bit of tennis. We've got great outdoor areas, a great gym, a lovely spa area. But actually, it's about making sure people get that leisure time that they want out of the membership. So, yeah, the learnings are maybe we could have gone bigger, but we didn't have land, I don't know.
yeah, you can always go up, I suppose.
Right, yeah, maybe.
So this podcast, you know, we are talking to a specialist in talking anxiety and well-being and all that sort of stuff. Is it something that you might think about offering? And, you know, we're stood in the studio now with a lovely stage. Is there something you thought about in terms of getting guest speakers in and things like that?
Yeah, so something that I've run at clubs in the past, we've sort of got guest speakers, you know, from sort of Bristol Rugby, Bristol Sport, that have come in and spoken to our membership about, I guess, exercise habits and training. And I think the more and more people explore wellness and well-being, and the more that people are open about their own experiences, I think there's absolutely a market for it. And I mean a market in a way of just letting people listen. There's always somebody that's quiet, and there's a reason that they're quiet, and let's try and get them talking. There's a lot about it in social media and in the press at the moment about, you know, it's good to talk, it's good to just take some time and talk to your family or talk to friends and things. And actually, I think that what we're trying to do, the buy one, get one free offer that we ran last week, was about wellness. It was about buy one meal, sit down with someone you don't know and have a meal together. I mean, it's quite unique, it's quite different, it's quite uncomfortable for some people to do that.
You've got to try these things, then.
You've got to try it out. And I think if we all just sort of took that approach and just watched the person that stood next to us at a bus stop or on, you know, getting on the same train as us, and you just said, how are you doing, and a bit more pleasant, then the world would be a happier place. And, you know, I'm preaching now, but, you know, we have that ethos in David Lloyd about making sure people feel included, and making sure that they exercise with us. And that, yeah, mindfulness and wellness is really important.
Brilliant.
So, yeah. Perfect. The answer to your question, yeah,
we've got
events.
Cool, that's great to hear. So we're almost 3 months in, and we're starting to rapidly approach the spring, summer. How excited are you to get people out using that spa? And I'm not, they're already out there now. Yeah. There's people out there now running from one bit to the next.
Look, I can't wait. I mean, we laugh about it when we were building this club and saying, you know, where will we put the DJ? Where will we put all the staff wearing all the white sort of clothing?
Pool parties.
You know what? We are bringing Puro Beach or Nikki Beach to Emerson's Green Area. And that is what it's truly going to be like. You know, we've got a DJ lined up. We've got outdoor music. Right. It will be a place to come, a destination. So don't worry about booking flights this year. Just make sure you book a car parking space, I guess. But no, come in and enjoy the facilities. It will all be open and up and running. We'll have outdoor bar service as well. Our handheld tills are going down really well. And we'll make sure that you can sit and relax on a sun lounger, and we'll come and get you a drink. So, you know, it's exciting. It will change the club. It'll change the usage of the club quite dramatically. But it's something that we're keen to see how it works. And, you know, at the moment, touch wood, everything's okay and it's busy. I think it could double the impact on the club, but that's great because I'll just bring more staff in.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Jack. We'll speak again soon. Take care.
Cheers. Thank you.